Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, a love letter to the women who shape me, published by Headline and coming in a new paperback edition on the 6th of February. For our fifth series of Your Book, we're in the USA, and today we're surrounded by some grand literary ghosts, including Henry James and William Thackeray, as we've gone to Gramercy Park to visit an author who conjures up the past while being very much still with us. Amor Towles, the author of A Gentleman in Moscow and Rules of Civility. Amor let us explore his fabulous library, and we talked about rigorous book clubs, the American literary tradition, and how we get more out of the best books as we grow up, like fine wine, only without the hangover. Enjoy. Is this your study? Is this where you work and write, as well as read?
Yes. This is my library and study. This is where I tend to work. But I guess what defines the books in this room, for the most part, it's the books that I have affected me enough or I take seriously enough that I like to have on hand, that I expect to return to, that sort of thing. I mean, and I am a contemporary author, but you will find few contemporary authors on these walls. I mean, the majority of the books here are by people who are dead.
Well, I've just spotted out a beautiful Edith Wharton edition. So it's a collection with The House of Mirth, The Reef, The Custom of the Country, and The Age of Innocence. And how do you feel about her New York? I always think of her as being a very sort of New York writer.
She's an amazing writer, and not simply in terms of her depiction of New York, which is itself fascinating, but as a writer of society, of relationships, of personal psychology, you know, she's one of the best in America, in the American tradition. So, but you know what I'll do is I'll tell you why that's there, is because I think, you know, this, you may find this interesting. I'm 55, and when I was turning 40, I had just read a series of contemporary novels by some well-known figures, and on the whole, I was disappointed with how the books affected me. You know, I did not find them to be as rich as I had hoped, or as thought-provoking, or whatever, maybe even as entertaining. And so around that time, I was reading a book by the American literary critic giant, Harold Bloom, where he kind of talked about the books that stirred wisdom over the course of his long career of reading everything and reading it multiple times, and kind of what is it about a book that would really engage him or make him think or make a lasting impression or potentially even change his life. And I walked away from reading that book and about the things that influenced him and really wanting to kind of circle back to spend more time reading books which were rich enough, subtle enough, artistically interesting enough, demanding enough, that it was the kind of book that would engage a reader and interest them, shape them if they read it at the age of 20, and then at 40, and then read it again at 60, and then 80, you know, at all four times, in essence having four different experiences. And it's a rare book that really can do that. And in pursuit of that, my general observation about writing and art and time is that I think that history is not very good at capturing all that is great in writing or painting or music. But history or time is very good at shedding what is mediocre. So if you're willing to kind of turn your dial back from not this, you know, what came out this month or what was came out last year, and look at 50 years ago, 70 years ago, 80 years, 100 years ago, what has kind of remained with us from that era, there's been a big winnowing, and the mediocre has been shoved aside, and you can find near the surface, you know, almost anything near the surface is going to have significance and substance to it, and has a good likelihood of meeting that goal of being a book that you might want to return to again and again. And so I was saying this, and that's why I was going to redirect my reading, in essence, in that direction. And I was saying this to a friend of mine at the time, and she said, "Listen, I want to do this with you. What, you know, what are you going to do, and how are you going to do it? What, you know, how can we do this together?" So we formed a reading group of, there's four of us, two men and two women, and we're all married, but our spouses are not involved, and we have now been reading together for 16 years. And so we read a book a month, and we target these kinds of books that are rich enough to have this sort of lasting and reverberating impact because of their artistic depth. And we do it by projects. So, you know, we'll do things like we read in a year, we read Whitman, Dickinson, Emerson, and Thoreau, the great writers of the American Renaissance, what we call the American New England Renaissance.
In another world, they would have been in a prog rock band, but there they are.
Well, yeah, I mean, those are probably the greatest artists who've come out of the, you know, out of American creativity. And you could spend your life reading just those four. But we then read from that. We then read five novels by Mark Twain, and then we read seven novels by Faulkner. And so I got sort of this trying to examine what is the evolution of the American voice over the course of what, in the end, was about almost a century. But like that was a year for us. We read The Remembrance of Things Past, you know, from beginning to end, the seven volumes. Very recently, we read with great satisfaction the British writer of The Raj Quartet, which, you know, Paul Scott, which are not very well covered in the United States. Maybe I don't know if they're
not really,
whether they're closely read. Do you know what they are? The Jewel and the Crown is the first of the four books, and was then made into a BBC miniseries. But the four novels are an incredible investigation of, well, I mean, sadly, the end of the British Empire, because the whole four books are set around the 5 years before the Second World War, the 5 years after, as England is in essence losing its hold on India and deciding to give it independence. And it's, you know, told from the perspective of British British citizens who've lived in India their whole lives, second generation, third generation, you know, military figures, political figures, civilians, but also then the Indian figures and the various factions over this. And so it's this kind of drama which circles back on itself, because it opens with a crime shortly before the Second World War, and everything that follows kind of is a reverberation around an investigation of all the people that were affected by this crime, but at the same time telling this history of the end of the colonial era from an Englishman's perspective. And it's an amazing, amazing book. So, you know, that's the kind of reading we do. So I say, if you looked in this room, it's not simply books that we've read as a group, but it's in that tenor. Now, I'm 55, and I studied literature at Yale. I got a master's in literature at Stanford. So I've been reading actively since I was a teenager. I've been writing fiction since I was a teenager. So for me, I don't have an influence here. What I have is waves of influences. You know, over the course of my life as a younger person, you know, I fell in love with Faulkner. And so, you know, well, you know, that's, you know, that's probably 20 of Faulkner's novels there in various elements, including that little artistic reproduction. There's Hemingway and Fitzgerald right above him, you know, because this is sort of Americans in this zone. Melville, who's a huge hero of mine, Thoreau, Emerson, Whitman, as I was just saying, are great heroes of mine. You know, I think of Moby Dick as probably the most important novel to come out of the American tradition. But, you know, more recently, like my friends and I, we read seven novels of Philip Roth, really the Zuckerman-related books, ending with American Pastoral and Human Stain, which are incredible books from later in his career. But as a younger person, I've been reading noir and mystery since I was a kid. And every summer, I treat myself by reading noir authors, crime authors, chronologically. You know, so that's Hammett's, the work of Hammett, the works of Hammett, the works of Raymond Chandler, the works of Ross McDonald, who is a little bit lesser known in Europe, but is the descendant of Chandler. And where Chandler's writing about L.A., in the 30s and 40s, Ross McDonald is writing about L.A. in the 50s and 60s.
So you kind of... Was that a contemporary setting for him?
In each case, yeah. Chandler is alive and writing in the 30s and 40s and, you know, created both The Big Sleep and other famous, you know, noir novels. And yes, Ross McDonald then came after him and wrote in the... and wrote in the 50s and 60s.
So when you were a teenager, can you remember the very first novel you picked up and it felt like it was just for you? It wasn't something that a parent or teacher had sort of recommended, that it just came into your hands and transported you and consumed you?
That kind of happens in different ways over the course of a reader's lifetime. As a young person, probably the first big discoveries were things like, I mean, I'm going to start even a little bit before teenager, discovering the Hardy Boys and the great pleasure of the fact that reading the first one, which is a mystery for young people, reading it and then sort of realizing when you're finished and you've enjoyed it that it's one of 35 and how exciting that is. You know what I mean? And I spent a summer reading those, got to the point where I was reading one a day and, you know, great pleasure from that. Later I discovered, Ray Bradbury, the great American science fiction and horror short story writer, and read his collected works, in essence. Agatha Christie, you know, I read from beginning to end, and recently reread from beginning to end not long ago, and take great pleasure in that.
Gosh, with Christie, that is an undertaking. There are a lot of...
I probably read, over a two-year period, read 50 of them. You know, but you're right, that's not the entire canon.
Who'd you prefer, Marple or Poirot?
Oh, yeah, I'm a Poirot person, probably. I'm probably more than a Marple person. But I enjoy them both. This last summer, again, in this sort of taking the summer to read crime, I read the nine George Smiley books by Jean Le Carré. And that was an extremely satisfying reading experience. Because Le Carré is not... It's a disservice to refer to him as a genre writer, as a spy novelist, because he's probably one of the best writers of the novel in the post-war era in England or in the United States too, and just as a stylist and as a psychologist, Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, and The Honorable Schoolboy are amazing books, and so. You know, but as I say, so those are kinds of fun things for me to do too. But yes, because I went, I went to Stanford, I continued to read. I had a phase where I investigated the magical realists and the related Latin Americans. You know, here I spent a great deal of time with the Russians, which is what led me to ultimately write A Gentleman in Moscow. And that began with Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, but then was Gogol and Bulgakov and Chekhov and the others. That's the library here, which has got French writing and, let's just say, Latin American writing. You know, 100 Years of Solitude is certainly one of my favorite books. So I've got, there's a lot of Marquez here and related type of work. From a reference standpoint, all of those are references for me. Conrad, I have over in the British section, although, of course, he's born in Poland, but probably the greatest writer in English not to have been a native speaker of English. Other than maybe a Nabokov, which would be the only, the other great one, writing in English, but not where it was his second language. Over there is the is Aristotle and Plato and Nietzsche and Descartes, and as well as compendiums of folk tales from Ireland, from India, from Russia from the mythologists and the mythologies of Greece and Rome, as well as Homer, you know, which are foundational type of works to refer to. Mm. Shakespeare for the same reason.
And I love this sense of time travel, but I think the wonderful thing about reading is as widely and as committedly as you do is you're constantly being yanked backwards and forwards, and yes. So many writers are making so many different references that you follow a thread and suddenly you're in the 1200s. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that you, if you're reading something deeply and the classical or a philosophical idea is being surfaced, it is a pleasure to go back and dig into that original material and sort of see how it resonates with the novel that was written 500 years later or what have you, or 300 years later.
And I think it comes back to what you were saying as well about, you know, after sort of the dust has settled and the hype has died down, that these books that really are, that we're still turning to sort of 50 years later or, you know, hundreds of years later.
Yes.
You know, that's, I think, sort of, the further back you go, the more these texts are still being passed around, then they're, you know, they've still got truth to tell us.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's right. And it's not, and it's interesting, if you look at the ones that have survived, they tend to be, at some level, very entertaining, but at that other level, and importantly, extremely rich and nuanced, right? So, but, you know, for it's not to write a book which is rich or informative and nuanced, but not to be engaging, it's not going to survive as well.
Absolutely.
You know, because ultimately you need people to want to go back and see it and to enjoy the process of reading it, but they need to be enriched by it too. And so, yeah, it's a small group.
I felt that way about Wharton when I first read her, being quite anxious, I think. I felt that she's very serious and really, really being taken aback and thrilled by how funny and observant and clear she was. Are there any writers like that for you, where you've really sort of gone in expecting something a little bit dry and then found them very vivid and
and again, one of the pleasures of reading these kinds of books is in some cases, my friends and I, we as a generation, we read them in college or in high school. And my friends and I were recently, in my group, we read a bunch of Russians a few years ago. And we read five novels of Dostoevsky. And when we were reading Crime and Punishment, which is the first of the five that we read, we all had all read it at the age of 19. And we all remembered it as a, you know, burdensome task, you know, as a heavy book with a dark, you know, philosophical bent and, you know, a dark moral viewpoint and sort of a slog. You know, we kind of remembered it that way. And when we returned to it in our, you know, at this point we were in our late 40s, we couldn't believe how entertaining it was. You know, it is a total page turner, and the investigation of the detective, you know, hounding Raskolnikov is great. As in its depiction, in the back half of the novel, there's a sociopath who kind of falls into Raskolnikov's circle, who's an amazing and chilling character. The relationship to the women in the book was very nuanced and moving. It's something that none of us remembered. Mm. We found social comedy in the book that none of us remembered. And yes, the philosophical stuff that we all remembered from our first reading of Russians was there. But it was a part of this bigger fabric of a much more engaging reading experience than we recalled as young people. And so that's part of the pleasure of going back, you know, because these books were not really written for 18-year-olds.
Yes.
And there's a point of view that the 18-year-old has which is going to limit the amount of satisfaction they can gain from a book like that.
Absolutely, that these books are really more and more relevant the more life you live.
Yes,
and
yeah.
You have to sort of see how well observed and how resonant and relevant it is, and to have lived it, to know it, I guess. Well, I hope there are no creepy sociopaths sort of hanging out the back of your books through your life.
No, but you know, then the Wharton that you're pointing to is a good example. We are reading that. I'm reading that with my friends. We're doing a project. We're going to read a series of American female writers of the 20th century, and we read, you know, four or five novels of each in chronological order. So we started with House of Mirth, and we read Comfort of the Country. We're reading Age of Innocence now. Again, relative to our memory of reading Wharton as younger people, it's so much more engaging and thoughtful. And you know, to the point you were just making, part of the reason that's true is because so much of it is about marriage and about the expectations of the of when you're in middle age, how, you know, or or when you're 30, how the 50-year-olds are looking at your decisions and that early stage of marriage or what have you. And you don't, as an 18-year-old, really have the perspective or experience to fully understand either the relationship issues involved, the personal issues involved in terms of building one's identity, or the multi-layered social aspects that are so intrinsic to her writing.
Absolutely.
Because at 18, you haven't really been through it.
You think, well, why don't people just say what they mean and do what they say they're going to do? Like, no, of course, nobody does that.
Nobody does it.
Right. Do you know, I'm sure you've come across Dawn Powell, who I guess she's a little bit later, but I love her, and I think she's someone I wish was better known in the UK.
And actually, that's one of the people that we think in this project of doing some Americans in a row, I think that we will do a few of her books. She's frankly not that well known in the United States, you know, is an amazing American female writer that is not as broadly read as she probably deserves to be.
I think you're right. I mean, I think this is a very good thing. We're aware that much of the canon is sort of quite white and male, and there are various sort of reasons for that. And I think it's exciting and hopefully progressive that that's being questioned. And I think part of it as well is it was easier for those people to have the opportunities to get published, I guess. But are you, in reading sort of Water and other female writers, are you noticing any kind of differences in terms of if, you know, there is a gendered lens, or do you just feel like a book is a book and a writer is a writer?
You know, I don't think that that's a dominant factor. We certainly benefit as readers from the fact that by the early 20th century or by the late 19th century, women were being published alongside men. Hmm. White, on the white basis, right? You know, certainly if we look at English writing, you know, Jane Austen is a 19th century pinnacle, you know. And so, but yes, we benefit from that. But what makes Wharton or Austen great is that they are writing in a way that men and women can read it mutually, and that it comments on humanity in a very open fashion. So that people of different races could read it, and people of different ages, people from different social classes, I think, could enjoy Wharton just as we did Shakespeare. And, you know, the thing about the canon is that the what gets included in a decade of the canon, as you say, is to some degree an accident of what happened in society 50 years before, because it takes time for social change to show up, you know, in the canon.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
People are going to write about it and write it. Well, they've got to live it for some time before they can.
And also the book has to survive, as you say, for 50 years. So, and if you look at, I'm a canonist, clearly, from the way I'm talking, you can tell. I have a very positive viewpoint about what is going on in the Western canon, in literature in particular. Because if you look at America, for instance, there's no question that the publishing arena is far more ahead than society in incorporating the voices of otherness. Now, so that doesn't show up necessarily in the canon in school today, but if you look up at what's been written and published and prized in the last 30 years in the United States, it's absolutely, you know, an extremely diverse body of work. Ethnically, by social class, by gender, by, you know, you name it. And if you look at some of the most important writers that have come out of the last 40 years, you know, you have Roth, who's a white male, but he's a Jewish, you know, white male who would have been an outcast, you know, relatively speaking, in 1900. It's Toni Morrison, obviously, you know, right now in this moment in time, it's people like Colson Whitehead, you know, or African-American, you know, writer out of New York. There is a robust output of these voices. So, but it takes, if you went back to 1850 in the West, or 1800 in the West, the vast majority of people of any color were illiterate, you know, relatively speaking. You know, they weren't allowed to go to school. So it wasn't just that the publishing industry wasn't publishing people other voices. The poor did not have access to publishing a voice for the most part. It was a long slog to end up in a position where you were self-taught in how to read, read enough that you have a sophisticated style, and then find a publisher, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's a very tough gating factor. Well, those gates have been pulled down in the United States for sure over the last 50 years, and you've seen that surge of in American writing the Asian American voice, starting in the 70s with Maxine Hong Kingston and Amy Tan, that continues today, and the Native American voice in America that, you know, begins with people like Louise Erdrich, you know, 30 years ago, and you know, more recently, you know, award winner Tommy Orange, you know, and you see it in terms of, as I say, the gay writing, and going back to James Baldwin, the African American voice, you know, being coming out of the 40s and 50s, but very strongly, and so it takes not only for that group to have access to education and literacy. To then be encouraged to find their own voices. Then you need a publishing industry that is willing to print those voices, which requires the existence of an audience who's shown interest in those voices. You know, these are all gating factors. And we've had that. So what we don't know is who out of that incredible explosion of diverse voices is going to be here 50 years from now. It's definitely not going to be all white men. That's for sure. You know, so it's because it's going to be based on the quality of the work.
Absolutely.
But so what I can guarantee you is that the canon, as it looks back over 100 years in, you know, America and English writing, it will be much more diverse than it was as it was defined in 1900. And that's not the quality of the books aren't necessarily going to be better or worse. They're still going to be rich, and that's why they survived, but you're going to have a much more varied group of voices that are contributing to it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now it's time for my Steal of the Week, the book version of A Case of Vintage Champagne, served by a team of lobsters in glasses made from diamonds and bitcoins. This week it's I Never Said I Loved You, the memoir by the Guardian columnist Rick Sameda. Fans of Rick's journalism will know he is very, very funny. But this book isn't just a comic masterpiece. It's a moving, devastating, and stunningly candid exploration of living with mental health problems, the complications of loving and understanding your family, and trying to make sense of your own humanity. Sometimes it's euphoric, sometimes it's painful, but it's not a chapter before lights out sort of a book. Once you've picked it up, it will stay in your hands until you've turned the last page. That's I Never Said I Loved You by Rick Sameda, published by Headline and out now. Now, back to Amor.
Now, you don't have to answer this if you would prefer not to, but of the sort of contemporary voices, and by contemporary I mean last 50 years, maybe still alive, who do you think will be reading still in 100 years?
Well, you know, Toni Morrison for sure. I think probably Toni Morrison is, you know, post-war America would be, you know, one of the single most important voices, and writes with great inventiveness, great compassion, great intricacy. And across a body of work, you can feel that it's a body of work, and yet she's exploring different narrative styles, different themes, you know, which have resonance with each other, but are varied. So, you know, somebody like that's going to be, there's no question. Now, maybe that's cheating because she's, you know, she was writing in the last 15 years, but has recently passed away. If you're talking about who started writing in the last decade, then, you know, that's anybody's guess.
I'd argue that Toni Morrison sort of, you know, embedded in the culture and the
there.
Canon.
Yeah.
Already, but I think it's interesting going back, I suppose, to talking about your book group, when you've got a writer who is so thrilling to read but also not afraid to experiment, and how you can see how their work changes and shifts and how
yes.
their voice matures.
Yeah. That's why we like to read a single author chronologically, is just for that reason. That's right.
So I'd love to hear your insights about that, and any particular authors that you've read where you've really noticed that shift and that evolution.
Well, you see it in anybody. I mean, that's the nature of reading, and that's true even, by the way, in reading the crime novels or something. But yes, when you're reading Faulkner chronologically, you're reading Morrison chronologically, you're reading Philip Roth chronologically, you are seeing the evolution of a point of view, of new challenges are being taken on. Not all writers would bother to do that. Some writers can write 8 novels that the 8th is not that different than the first, you know. And obviously, I like genre fiction. A lot of genre writers write like that. You know, they're each book is kind of like the last to some degree.
And I think very occasionally, perhaps I think this is much more an issue in contemporary fiction writing, that you have a writer who becomes sort of incredibly successful and it gets a little sloppy. You know, you've got a book that's like, you know, 10,000 pages long, and you think the editor really should have gone in on this a bit more rather than be like, oh no, but they're fabulous and it'll sell all the copies, it's fine.
No, that definitely can happen. It is possible to write a great book or two and be a capable writer where you do not, over the course of a career, generate a body of work that's going to stand the test of time, right? I mean, it is... that happens all the time. There are a lot of tantalizing books of the last 40 years where they're not necessarily one-offs, but they're close to it, you know, in terms of how that author stacked up over time. So, yeah, it's an added challenge for those writers that are going to strive time to not simply write a great book, but to build on that, through experimentation, through a commitment to ideas, through an ongoing curiosity, which to some degree requires stamina. Mm. You know, these people have to be willing to leave whatever success has given them, ignore it for a minute, go back and retreat into privacy, and push back how their ego has been rewarded by their success, and find new cause to investigating something from scratch, you know, and that's kind of what it requires to start doing, to you know, where the 4th and 5th and 6th books are quite striking. I don't mean to keep returning back to Roth. He's not one of my biggest heroes, but I said we read him in the last 2 years, so he comes to mind. One of the most amazing things about reading Roth chronologically is, and he created a huge body of work. I'm sure not all of it is worth, you know, a reader's time, but the fact that American Pastoral and Human Stain, which are clearly two of his greatest books, came quite late in his career is an amazing achievement in its own right. You know, he had written many, many books by the time, and shorter books in many cases, and books that in many cases were more similar to each other. Working his way towards, you know, these two novels that are much more challenging, much more intricate, much more intriguing, stylistically much more impressive. You know what I mean? That's quite extraordinary when you think about that. Like to a writer of that talent, to 30 years into his career, to keep finding a new level of depth and breadth in his work. I mean, that's amazing.
I think that's really inspiring and really hopeful.
Yeah,
I mean, I figure this is why writers are not athletes. You don't want to do your best work before you're 30. Yeah, you want to keep building on it and keep doing it.
Yeah, like someone like Fitzgerald, it was like all over by the time he was 45 or whatever, you know, I don't even remember.
Oh,
but, you know, it's painful, but...
Love those novels, but he made some bad choices, that man.
Yeah, that's true. You know, he paid the price for his bad choices.
What was the last book that you gave to someone as a gift?
Last book I gave to someone as a gift?
Or the last book you were given as a gift?
Yeah.
Do people buy you books, or do they figure that you have everything you want and need already?
You know, I haven't given it yet, but this... I had never seen before, but I was in London. Oh, no, this isn't the one that was in London. Where is it? Well, anyway, my friends who I read with, some number of years ago, our project was we took a year and we read winners of the Nobel Prize in Literature who did not originally write in English, where we collectively had not read their work. And so we read Kenzaburo Oe from Japan. We read some Thomas Mann. We'd all read The Magic Mountain, but we hadn't read much of Mann. And we read, you know, we all loved Buddenbrooks. It was an amazing book. But we then read Nagib Mahfouz, who is the first writer to win the Nobel Prize in Literature in Arabic. And he wrote three novels, which are called the Cairo Trilogy. And that's an incredible body of work, an amazing group of novels. So this just came out, which is a group of short stories by him. So this is what I'm giving to my three reading friends.
Lovely gift. Who publishes that?
That one is, I don't even heard of it. Saki. What is this?
Saki, S-A-Q-I. And the foreword is by Alif Shafak. Podcast alumni.
This is a British publication, I think. There's Simon Sebag on the back.
Ah.
Can
you remember where you got it from? Which shop in there?
I actually got in the United States, but it must. I wonder if it's an import. I don't know. But it says. Well, I guess it's got the two different prices. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether it's where it's originally United. But anyway, so yes, that I'm excited about. I have not read it yet, but I got four copies so that I can give them to my friends.
Fabulous. So then I guess they will have to get you a gift of some description, so you might have all sorts of exciting books coming your way.
Right.
May I see what else is in this pile?
Well, this is this is a gift from my brother, which I have not read. Harry Matthews is an American writer who died some years ago, who I'm fond of. Jonathan Lethem's Motherless Brooklyn. I haven't read it yet. The movie's coming out. But Jonathan is an acquaintance.
You have to get it before the edition comes out. Yeah. Now a major motion picture.
I know. This is James Baldwin's Goatout on the Mountain. My new novel is, which I'm trying to finish in the course of the next few months, is set in the mid-50s in the United States. And so when I'm writing a book, I often like to read around it. I don't want to read a book that's like the book I'm writing. Mm. But I like to read books that are kind of set in the time period, that were written in the time period, excuse me. My book's set in 1954, and so I have read this year so far, or the last 2 years, 3 years, Flannery O'Connor's first collection of short stories is from then. James Baldwin's Go Tell It on the Mountain is from then.
May I look at this?
Yeah.
Really stunning. Is that a first edition?
No, but it is a reprint of the first edition.
So that's
Knopf. Yeah, Knopf re-released this as an anniversary edition.
It's beautifully done. It's
almost like
the Folio Society ones.
It's that kind of a thing. I'm reading those. I read the Man in the Gray Flannel Suit was a famous novel from the mid-50s. Kind of about the guys, about Mad Men, in essence, pre-Mad Men. It's about the guys who went to work in their gray flannel suits and fedoras. And what's fun to go and do a project like that for me as a writer is that Flannery O'Connor's writing about, you know, the South in 1954, and it's relatively impoverished, you know, in her quirky religious style. James Baldwin writing about the exact same period of time about Harlem, you know, and the young person who's sort of coming out into himself. In Harlem, and whereas the Man in the Gray Flannel Suit was written by a returning vet, writing about kind of this experience of the suburban white guy and, you know, going to work every day in Midtown Manhattan. And so you have these I just finished David Goodis's two of his crime novels from 1954, which are kind of West Coast, very rough, you know, stevedores getting stabbed on the pier kind of thing. So all these books are written within 24 months of each other, you know, but they are all, and by extremely talented writers.
Totally different textures.
Exactly right. So it's kind of that nice, healthy reminder that all of this was the sound of America in 1954 for me. I get to kind of put it down and think about it and say, oh yeah, exactly right. You know, the dock guy, the Southern, you know, lady, the suburban, young black Harlemite, all are American, all, you know, at that point in time, but with very different tones, very different concerns, very different landscapes that they're living in.
I And I think that's probably how books endure and how one writes books that do endure, because, you know, going back to that sort of the canon and how that's slowly becoming more diverse, that, yes, I think that what we're learning now, what I hope we're learning, is that, you know, it's not as though you only need to read books by people or about people who are like you or
absolutely not.
Yeah. And that, so in the sort of the fuller, that, you know, that sense of who people are and where they are is, the richer the resulting book.
Yes.
I have to ask about the pile of hats on that chair. Oh, is that to do? They look, always look a little bit 1954. Maybe, well, is that anything to do with the book?
I think
that's more of a bowl. You know, that's a nice British style bowler, I guess. But yeah, I wear hats.
Ah.
I have more than that, believe me.
just a small sample of the hats. I might look at that shelf of British books. That's okay.
Yeah,
well, is that just funny?
Yeah. Which, you know, it's probably embarrassing to shout. My buddies and I, we read Remembrance of Things Past, and then we read Anthony Poole, The Dance of the Music of Time.
There.
Said his name correctly. Very good.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Very,
thank you. Few.
I mean, I only just learned how to.
This is Dickens. Ishiguro, I mean, Remains of the Day is a, you know, contemporary writer. That book will last for a long time. It's an extraordinary book. Conrad, who we talked about, you know, is a big hero of mine. Ford Madox Ford's The Good Soldier is, I think, one of the greatest 20th century novels. I'm a big fan of, obviously, Wolfe and Joyce, Dickens.
After this glares out at me, because it's a book I love, and it's not one that I expected to see on your shelf.
Yeah.
You have Baden Place.
I have not read that yet, but these are all the books from that this moment in time I'm describing.
Ah.
So Cheever, The Wapshot Chronicles, Peyton Place is a mid-50s book. That's the Flannery O'Connor we talked about, The Man in the Grey Flannel Suit. John O'Hara, Cheever, Bellow, Welty are all writing in the mid-50s. The moviegoer, mid to late 50s maybe. And this is the American sci-fi in the 50s, which is a whole other category of what's going on at that time.
So
this is kind of a shelf just which, once I'm done that book, all this will get moved.
I'm fascinated by past depictions of the future.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, right. Fascinating, yeah.
These look great. These are, I'm just going to take a little peek at that beautiful edition. I don't know if that looks, it's in such nice condition. I don't know.
I did get through a secondhand, you know, format, so I don't even know when it's from.
It's not got any.
Does it not have a?
There's no sort of.
Right there?
Oh, here we go. Oh, yep, copyright 1956.
Yep.
Oh, how fabulous. So your organizing is that it's whatever you're working on at the moment.
Yeah, it's kind of on that shelf. So there have been a lot of Russian novels there 3 years ago. Don't worry if that falls down, that's all right.
I will make sure. It's like Jenga or something.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Do you have sort of book purges? Do you keep every book that comes in, or do you?
Well, we have the luxury of having a country house, so there's a library in the country house, and so the lack of 20th century or post-war fiction here, all those books are there. You know, I'm both a friend and admirer of Ann Patchett. I'm a friend and admirer of Richard Russo. I read all their books. I'm a fan of Colson Whitehead's as well. And so all of that, my books of kind of that era tend to be out there. But yeah, if I read a book and I'm not very impressed by it, I don't tend to keep it.
Do you finish everything you start, or do you ever get to a point where you think, no, not for me?
I do not do that. You know, there's a... The great American librarian named Nancy Pearl, and who has she articulates this rule, which I agree with and abide by, which is that anybody who reads a book should be willing to make some investment in it. That you shouldn't have to finish anything, but you should make some investment, and the way you determine the investment is that it's your age. Sorry, it's 100 minus your age. So if you're 20 years old, you should be willing to read 80 pages in a book before you cast it aside. But if you're 80, 20 is just fine. You know, if you're 99, give it a page, and if you don't like it, you can move on. You know, but yeah. So I'm quite happy to turn into something and say this is definitely not something for me, and just move on. I'm not going to bog myself down.
Oh, that is a great rule. I guess there's just so much.
Yeah, there's so much. You have to make your choices.
Which authors have you never read but you're excited to read? Is there anyone out there that you've never quite got to yet, but they're on the, you know, your future
those
book group
are always percolating up. I've never read anything by Iris Murdoch, but you know what people have told me is, you know, it's an amazing writer. I'd love to spend time, you know, doing that. So, you know, she'll end up on a list sometime where, you know, we'll circle back. But there's all kinds of people that fit that description. I haven't read as much Dickens as I'd like. I'd like to go and I'd love to do nothing more to make me happier than to spend a year working through Dickens' entire body of work, or, you know, or most of it.
Because I think Dickens is possibly more in the UK, but just so absorbed and enmeshed in the culture. Yeah. It's very easy, I think, for everybody to feel as though they've read a lot more Dickens than they have because the references just
well,
flow.
That's right.
Maybe have a look over there. By that. You've got a proper library ladder.
Well, yeah.
It's all right. I'm not going to climb
this
up.
This gets
it.
A little weird over here. So this is reference. So, you know, that's the OED, obviously. That's a usage. That's the Bible. A Treasury of Western Thought is a large compendium of quotations. Style guide. This is an etiquette guide. Emily Post. These are the rules to card games.
Fabulous. Can I have a look at Emily Post?
Yeah, sure. Not that I turn to that on a weekly basis, but it's there.
Sort of running after guests with it. So this is... in its 17th edition.
Well, yeah, that's an older edition, though.
But I love that they kept kind of, you know, the etiquette will change year on year.
Yeah, yeah,
and
sure.
When there is no host, a hostess who is either a widow or unmarried asks the man she knows best, a relative if there is one present, to act as host. He gives his arm to the guest of honour and leads the way to the dining table where he sits opposite the hostess. After dinner, he leads the men to the smoking room and later to the drawing room to join the ladies. So, what if there is no man? Get an emergency man.
Yeah,
that's how they played it in 1927.
That's one sentence, right.
We've just discovered these Paris Review interviews.
Yes. Those are great. I mean, that they've been compiling and sharing those interviews with various authors. And those are great fun because, as I say, we read projects, or I do. So occasionally someone that we're reading will be in there. So you get to kind of go back and say, oh, well, I want to go here. Read the Mufu's interview now that I've read the Mufu's body of work and that kind of thing. These are great fun for me, which is, well, this is an encyclopedia.
Ooh.
But it's an encyclopedia from 1938, which is hugely fun and valuable to me because I've written a book set in 1938. Because you can go to New York and get the population that year. You can get all kinds of, and what's included is obviously very idiosyncratic.
But it's much more reliable than Google, and you're not going to go down a wormhole.
And I've owned this longer than Google existed, I guess. But it's that kind of thing. And these are WPA guides. The WPA was during the Depression, the American government created this thing called the Works Projects Administration to hire painters, writers, historians, and give them jobs. And so this was the travel guide from 1938 that was written in 1938. And it's the original. It's not a rare edition. It's a contemporary printing of the 1938 guide, and the WPA did guides for all across the country. So for San Francisco, South Dakota, whatever. But again, it's a great resource to kind of, you want to get a feel for life in the 30s. That's, you know, there's no faster way to do it than
because I suppose it's what people wanted to know then.
Yeah. Well, its description of Times Square is incredibly vivid and poetic for the saying, you know, if you come to New York, it's 1938, if you come to New York, go to Times Square, and this is what you can expect to find. And it then gives a very detailed description, and it's like, okay, right, that's Times Square in the 1930s. So this is kind of a lot of that. And these are poets, playwrights.
Oh, Fab, I wanted to ask you about poetry. So who I see, Coleridge, I see Wordsworth.
I mean, this is Yeats,
John Donne, Yeats,
Dickinson, Neruda, Pound,
T.S.
Eliot, you know, is a hero of mine.
Emily Dickinson's having a bit of a renaissance at the moment, isn't she?
Well,
there's that
TV show.
But...
Well, I mean, she's never really gone out of fashion. But certainly the TV will put her a little bit back in the spotlight.
I think it's really interesting. I'll find it and put it in the show notes. Amongst teenage girls, I've got very, very, and maybe that's always been the case, and it's sort of that kind of, Sylvia Plath syndrome. There's something about her at the moment and her sort of very, I suppose, singular vision and that driving rhythm of prose.
Yeah, that's true, and that's being created a little bit, as I say, by Hollywood, and, you know, they're also reinventing what in the movies and in TV, what she was like, you know, in this fanciful fashion.
But I guess that's only happening because there is this sort of strange ground swelling of, you know, people want the Emily Dickinson content. I think that's coming from somewhere.
Know. But yeah, certainly. But as an American writer, Dickinson has never gone out of style, not since she was discovered.
Jean, I don't read nearly as much poetry as I'd like to. And I think there's something about, you know, you can sit and read a novel, and that's something that there's always, I think, space for in one's day. You can tell I don't have any children. But I don't know when I'd reach for a poem. Do you think you, with your book group, have you covered any poets?
We did Dickinson, we've done Whitman, we've done some poetry, but it's not a big focus of ours. And nor is it poetry is something that I read with far less frequency than narrative. I mean, I'm a narrativist at the end of the day. And it's important to... You learn a lot about what can be achieved in language by reading poetry closely. But yeah, as you say, I would not read a poem a day, you know, or go to bed at night reading poetry for the most part.
I suppose, you know, that it's a lesson of style and economy. But,
yes, that's right.
Yeah, I think it's that makes a lot of sense. I wanted to look at the plays as well.
And again, there's not a lot, because I don't read a lot of theater, but, you know, there's Miller, which, of course, is one of the great American playwrights, Eugene O'Neill, Beckett, you know, obviously a key player. I mean, in Tennessee Williams, a major American playwright. So I've got, you know, some, but it's not my focus. If you went to the home of a playwright, I'm sure you'd find walls of drama.
So if you were going to write something that wasn't a novel, is that something you'd have any interest in, or do you think you want to just focus on?
I'm going to keep focus on novels. That's my thing.
I think it's good to know.
I write short fiction, but novel is my preferred form.
I think we've seen a few short stories. Who are your favorite short story writers?
Writers? You know, these are some of the American writers of less contemporary, more like, you know... But, Peter Matheson was a great hero of mine and was a friend, but Raymond Carver, you know, is to me, you know, one of the great American short story writers for sure. This is somebody who I think will stand the test of time. Cormac McCarthy will be read for a long time from now. He's an amazing American writer, but I'm a big fan of obviously Chekhov's short stories and others too. This is, by the way, that's from my brother-in-law, but I've read those. Those are first editions of James Bond. That's the entire James Bond output.
Except for one Kingsley Amis, driving me insane.
I know.
Oh, but it's the James Bond somethings. I haven't got my
Yeah,
on.
You know, he did...
the James Bond dossier.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's kind of it's a book he wrote about it. Yeah.
Oh.
About Fleming.
Ah. And have you read all of those?
I've read most of those.
Right. And what are your thoughts?
I loved them. I love them. The early ones are great fun.
Mm.
And they're very stripped down, which is what makes them fun.
And that was a gift from your brother-in-law,
yeah.
Did you say?
Because he knows. He knows that. Bond was something that I read when I was a kid, because my dad was a fan. We would go to the movies, and so I read a number of the novels as a kid. And I think I had mentioned that to him at one point. So maybe for my 40th birthday or something like that, he gave me that set.
That's an amazing gift. Were there any other books that you sort of read with your parents, or you'd... read alongside each other?
My reading and crime began with my dad. I mean, he was an Agatha Christie reader, a Rex Stout reader, whose detective is Nora Wolfe. He read Hammett and Chandler, you know, so I began reading mysteries really because of my dad, for sure.
And I think it's so important to see someone enjoying a book. I think it's really
powerful
to know that that's something, because I think it's just, you know, pretty much the most democratic hobby in the world. You just need, you know, the book and time, and then, you know, you can go anywhere you want to.
Yeah, as long as you know how to read, that's right.
Never be bored.
Never be bored.
Huge thanks to Amul. Follow him at Amul Tolls on social media. Rules of Civility and A Gentleman in Moscow are out now. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, fellow paperback chasers. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyB. Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people to find the podcast. For now, I leave you with this, attributed to Albert Camus. A character is never the author who created him. It is quite likely, however, that an author may be all his characters simultaneously. See you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.